Going directly to the subject, one of the things that I started out with, and I think some of the other speakers have as well, and that is to emphasize that of understanding what it is that we're looking at. After all, the words that we use, that's the primary means that we communicate with one another, and we recognize that within the English language, there are a number of words that may be pronounced alike, and yet they are not the same. You can take the word to, and it can be T-O, T-O-O, or T-W-O, and obviously there's a difference in meaning. And when you look at the King James translation, and it's one I happen to prefer, but I also recognize that there are some very fine words there that convey a meaning. They're still good English words, but they simply do not mean the same thing that they meant at the time when the King James was written. So it is important that we not only be able to understand the words, but that the words do in fact convey the very meaning that they were intended to convey. If the initial scriptures as written spoke with regard to grain, and we end up with it saying wagon, those are both two good English words, but obviously we end up with some different meaning. So this is part of the situation when we begin to think with regard to the word covenant, and want to start out with that. And I don't know, you may already have given some thought. If not, then you might right now, as to just what does covenant mean to you. Well, let me give you several definitions that you might find. Matter of fact, one of them that I have comes from the American Heritage Dictionary. It says a binding agreement or contract. As a second meaning, and this one was quite interesting because it drew from the Bible. It states God's promises to man as recorded in the Old and New Testaments. Vines indicates in the discussion on covenant with regard to the New Testament, he states that in contradistinction to the English word covenant, a coming together, which signifies a mutual undertaking between two parties or more, each binding himself to fulfill obligations, it does not in itself contain the idea of joint obligations. It mostly signifies an obligation undertaken by a single person. Well, although he poses it as being different than the English uses it, the truth of the matter is the English use of the word otherwise corresponds very closely to what Vine said. Thayer, in the Greek-English lexicon on the New Testament, provides that it is a disposition arrangement of any sort which one wishes to be valid, and secondarily, a compact or covenant. He goes on to indicate that it primarily signifies a disposition of property by will or otherwise, and is also the rendering of the Hebrew word meaning covenant. And then go to a more legal source, which is the book Corbin on contracts. And Corbin indicates that the word covenant has come to mean not much more than a synonym for a promise. However, at one time, the meaning may have been that of a formal promise under seal. Now, if you have taken note with regard to those definitions, they did not agree completely. Matter of fact, they posed three different potential meanings. One of those is that of a promise. Another is that of a contract or agreement. And a third is that of a testament or will. And by the way, though this material is in the book, I'm not following, and you probably have already noticed, I'm not following in the same order that it's given in the book. Well, we'll want to look at these three different areas because they do play a part. And one of the last things that I noted, and it might be useful just to provide a little bit of history, Corbin had said that it really relates to a promise And at one time, it appears to have related to a formal promise under seal. Now, during most of the history of this world, at least the large majority of people could not read nor write. This would have been true even in the early part of the history of this country. So there were those documents that were considered to be of a formal nature. Now, we might think today of a formal document of one that has been made up of as a legal document, such as a deed, and say that's a formal document. Well, that wasn't the concept some years ago. It was one where it was the form that was important, not the contents. Keeping in mind, people could not generally read and write, but they weren't stupid. And they could look and compare. And often the same thing was true orally. If you could repeat something precisely the way that it was initially given, then it carried a lot of weight. And so the document, if it was a formal document, was one then that individuals, as they compared, it compared with the previous. But the seal was another aspect, and that you perhaps be more readily familiar with, the putting the blob of wax on the document. And the individual who was in the position of authority and having the ring would put the impression in that seal of wax. And this, of course, would indicate the authority by which this was being carried out. I might mention, by the way, as I was talking about the formal document, some aspects of that still has carried down to our present day and time, and those particularly within the oil industry, perhaps some, not too many years ago anyway, with regard to oil leases. There was a particular oil lease form that landowners generally liked, and it came to be known by its number. And so if it was that form, they were inclined to immediately sign off. Well, it didn't take some of the other folks very long to simply take that form, leave the number, but change the language more to their own liking. And, of course, many of the landowners nevertheless signed off because seeing that number, there's some of the modern-day aspects of that type of formality. We have an expression today that you may still hear that very likely is a throwback to a lot of this. When we talk about a document, or we might apply it otherwise, indicating that it has been finished and that we say it has been signed and sealed and delivered. Well, the delivery was another aspect of it. So here, if you really wanted to ensure that everything was finally done and everything was legal, well, the final act, of course, the form was there, the seal was there, and now when you delivered it personally to the individual involved, it was finished, it was completed. So, again, I suspect that's where we go back to the idea of signed, sealed, and delivered. Well, when we come to the Old Testament, and we'll look at that first, with regard to vines, the indication is that the Hebrew word for covenant is used in the Old Testament some 280 times. Now, when you break that down, and here looking primarily at the King James, in some instances the King James uses the word league, while in other translations they sometimes use treaty or compact. And some of these instances where that word is used, it relates to those situations that involve one nation with another or one individual with another. But most of them, about 260 out of the 280 instances in the Old Testament where the word covenant is used, relates to the relationship that is occurring between God and man. And that's what we're going to be looking at just a little bit more closely. As a matter of fact, God made a number of covenants. And I want to just mention some of those to you. In Genesis 6 and 18, God told Noah, "But with thee will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark. Exodus 6 and 5, God speaking to Moses. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. In Exodus 19, 5 and 6, God says, now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. Now you begin to notice something with regard to this language. And you'll find it taking place in a number of cases. God doesn't say, our covenant. This is a covenant between us. He says, this is my covenant. And you'll also notice that seems he ties commandments in with that. Well, let's stop for a moment and look at some of the terms that have been used, and I particularly made mention with regard to three, that is, that of a promise, that of a contract, and that of a testament. Those are three different things, and I'm sure that you recognize it. A promise, of course, can be made by one individual. Now, you can even be in a room all to yourself, the only one there, and you can make a promise. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to refrain from doing. And quite generally, at least when promises are made to other individuals, you in many instances are not able to enforce them. You might have a situation where you come into a large sum of money and you are so happy with respect to this that you immediately rush next door and promise your neighbor that you've never really gotten along with anyway, but now that you've gotten this money and you're so happy about it, you say, I'm going to take us on a vacation. Well, there's a good chance that they might not be able to uphold that, and I sort of a caution there, because in this day and time it's hard to tell how some things are going to turn out. But normally you wouldn't expect that. Now, on the other hand, if you had told the neighbor, listen, I'm going to take you on a vacation and we'll be going to places where I'm sure you don't have the proper luggage and the proper clothing, and you need to go ahead and make that kind of preparation, and the neighbor does so, then very likely the promise would have to be upheld. But in any event, promises only takes that of the one individual. Now, when you come to a contract, as I'm sure that you would appreciate, that it takes more than one person. And there's some basic attributes of a contract. It may not always be observable, but on both parties, or how many parties there are, it requires that of an offer, of an acceptance, and of consideration. And generally, consideration, just very simply, is the inducement that leads the individual to enter into the contract. And the offer might likewise be spoken of as being a conditional promise. And in essence, what is taking place in what would be spoken of as being bilateral contracts is that there's two parties, that each one, in effect, makes a conditional promise or offer. Each one makes an acceptance of the terms. Can't go changing the terms. Each one makes an acceptance. And each one gives some consideration. So if I'm selling a riding mower for $750 and I offer it at that price, then in essence, if you are the buyer, you're offering likewise to buy that mower and to pay that particular price. And of course, the consideration on the one part is I'm giving you the mower, and on the other hand, you're giving me the money. So those attributes are there. When you look at a will or a testament, you clearly are looking at something that is entirely different, and I'm sure you recognize that as well. We're talking about the disposition of one's property upon their death. And though in essence we might think that every individual has the right to make that kind of a disposition, yet obviously the laws of the state will determine what constitutes a legal will. And by the way, the word testament is rarely used in this day and time. You'll perhaps see it in the heading of last will and testament, but you'll probably not see it other than there. But during the lifetime of the individual, and so many, of course, you'll be urged to have a will to make a proper disposition of your property so it's being dealt with as you desire. In addition to that, there are, of course, some other matters that can be included, such as the appointment of your executor or executrix. If you have children, that of designating the guardian, things of this nature. But while you're still alive, you have just as much control and authority with regard to the use and disposition of the property as you would if you never had a will. It's not even necessary that those who constitute your heirs even know whether they've been included or not. While you're still alive, they have absolutely no right to the property. They cannot use it for collateral. They cannot take any control of it. It simply is not theirs, and they have no rights with regard to it. Here then, what we're talking about with respect to these terms, and yet these are the terms that have been used within the definitions that we found, and we'll be wanting to look at these as we go forward. I want to go back and pick up and make some reference to instances when individuals, however, did speak in terms of entering into a covenant with God. In Deuteronomy 29, 10 through 12, speaks of the children of Israel standing before the Lord that they should enter, or in the margin, pass, into a covenant with the Lord. And likewise, in Jeremiah 50, verses 4 and 5, speaks of the children of Israel and Judah coming together and saying, "Let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten." Now, in a few moments, time permitting, I want to talk about why we don't really have a contract with God. And therefore, in this instance, or these instances, it's not talking about entering into a contract with God. I would liken it more into that of suggesting the type of situation, to use an illustration, where there is a tremendous storm that is coming. You're out in the open with others, and learning of the approaching storm, you say, "Let us hurry and get to a place of safety, a place of refuge." And I think that's in actuality what the children of Israel are talking about. Let us join into a covenant relationship with God. Let us go where there is safety. Let us go where there is protection and where we will be cared for. Let me mention another term, however, that is used in conjunction with the word covenant in the Old Testament, that when used in conjunction with the word covenant, it means to cut into two pieces, or cutting a covenant. Now, I don't know if it came from this use or not, but I know that I've heard people use the term to cut a deal, and I don't know where that came from, but it might indeed be a throwback to this. You very likely remember just exactly what I'm referring to, because in Genesis 15, 5 through 21, God had spoken to Abram with regard to the promises that he had made to Abram respecting how of his seed they would be as the stars of the heaven, and how that his seed would inherit the land. And Abram wondered or wanted some kind of assurance as to the fact that this was going to come to pass. What was done would seem strange to us today. Well, you'll remember what occurred. He told Abram to take a heifer, she-goat, a ram, turtle dove, young pigeon. And other than the birds, they cut those animals in two and put them end to end. And parallel. And then we're told that when it was dark, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp passed between the pieces that were there. And in verse 18, it went on to state that in the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. Every indication is that this was not something that was just new and strange to Abram, but was really a practice that was known and utilized as individuals entered into that type of a relationship. As a matter of fact, something better than 1,000 years later, in Jeremiah chapter 34, God speaking said, "And I will give," this is verses 18 and 19, "I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant, which they had made before me when they cut the calf in twain and passed between the parts thereof. The princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs and the priests and all the people of the land which passed between the parts of the calf." Some 1,000 years later, I think they understood very well that which had taken place, just as I'm sure that Abram did, and that with that which transpired, he accepted that as an indication that God was going to carry out his promise just as he had indicated. Let me turn more to the New Testament at this time. I've already made some reference, of course, to the definitions, but notice that in the New Testament, in the King James, and that's again where I'm primarily referring to, some 20 times it's translated as covenant, 13 times as testament. Same word. In the Revised Standard, the New American Standard versions, only covenant is used. Well, there were some differences of opinion, and I want to call these to your attention so that you can see something of the nature of what was occurring. And the passage that I want you to turn to is Hebrews 9, verses 15 through 17. And apparently what was taking place is that some of the scholars were saying that covenant should be used consistently throughout. Use only the word covenant. Others were saying use the word testament throughout. Wherever you find the word, use only one or the other. I want to call to your attention the readings from the King James, the American Standard, and the New American Standard. And again, this is for Hebrews 9, verses 15 through 17. The King James. "And for this cause he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. For where a testament is, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For a testament is of force after men are dead, otherwise it is of no strength at all while the testator liveth." Now, you'll notice that the King James makes reference to a first testament. And one of the things that might immediately come to your mind, if we're going to be talking about two separate testaments, and by the way, if I understand it correctly, that the idea of a testament is not raised within the Old Testament at all, or what we call the Old Testament. It's only raised in the New. And here, of course, he does speak of the first testament. Now, if you had a testament and a first one, it suggests a couple of things. One, the initial would be that God had a first testament, and if you have a last will and testament, at the time you prepare it, it is with the intention that it is the final document in that realm, and that is as far as dealing with your property. Now, you can change it later, and that one, you want to annul the first and tear it up, and then that one becomes. The idea then would carry that at some point that there had been a first one, and this was God's full intention of dealing with everything, and then decided at some point to annul that one and then to give a new one. Well, that obviously is not the case at all. The first was a covenant, and we know that it was simply to serve as a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. It simply was not a testament as such. Now, when you look at the American Standard, it reads that for this cause he is the mediator of a new covenant, that a death having taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant, they which have been called may receive the promise of eternal inheritance. For where a testament is, there must of necessity be the death of him that made it. For a testament is of force where there have been death, for it doth never avail while he that made it liveth. Well, personally, I think that is the appropriate language. It speaks with regard to the first covenant, that we now have a new one, but then introduces the thought of a testament or will and the necessity of the death of the testator in order for it to take effect. Notice, on the other hand, the language being used in the New American Standard. And for this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, in order that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it never is in force while the one who made it lives. And that is absurd. But they have insisted on using the word covenant throughout. But obviously, one makes promises, enters into various arrangements, and as a matter of fact, if death comes, as a normal rule, it's going to terminate. It's not going to be something that only comes into existence when the person dies. The very thing, the covenant itself, is going to likely end with the death of the individual. Now, I see Tommy is already here. I'll touch on one area. Obviously, if I haven't made it clear, the indication is, I think, that, again, the use of the Old Testament, that terminology, is really a misnomer. We do indeed have a testament, that which comes to us through Jesus Christ. We have an old covenant, and then we have a new covenant. What we have, of course, are promises of God, and we want to bring ourselves within those promises. Let me suggest very quickly with regard to some reasons as to why we do not have a contract with God. Well, I've mentioned with regard to the necessity of consideration. It's that which induces some individual to enter into the agreement with the other party. Both individuals having an inducement so that it is the matter that's agreeable to both. Truth of the matter is, man has absolutely nothing to come to God with in the way of consideration. There's just nothing there. Everything upon the face of this earth, including man himself, already belongs unto God. We have nothing to trade. We have nothing to give. There is a particular provision that at times comes into play in contracts that relates to pre-existing obligations. For example, if you had someone who broke into your home, stole a lot of items from you, you placed an ad in the paper offering a reward for anyone who might find the killer, the one who has stolen the items, and the item be returned to you. See that justice is done, you'll give the reward. Well, if a policeman captures the thief, returns the property to you, he's not entitled to the reward. Primary reason being, of course, pre-existing obligation. That was his duty. That was his job. To catch the crooks, restore the goods. Is there anything of that nature within the Scriptures? Well, you might turn with me over to the 17th chapter of the book of Luke. And beginning with verse 7, where Jesus said, "But which of you, having a servant plowing or feeding cattle, will say unto him by and by when he has come from the field, 'Go and sit down to meat,' and will not rather say unto him, 'Make ready wherewith I may sup, and gird thyself, and serve me till I have eaten and drunken, and afterward thou shalt eat and drink?' Doth he not thank? Or doth he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded of him? I trow not. So likewise ye, when ye have done, shall have done all those things which are commanded you, say, 'We are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do.'" We already have an obligation to do everything that God has commanded of us. And sometimes you hear of people, and maybe you've done it yourself, in great difficulty, perhaps it's illness that you have, or remember your family, or other problems, and you may make a good number of promises unto God. "I'm going to go to church regularly. I'm going to pray regularly. I'm going to be better to my family. I'm going to do great and wonderful things for you." Well, every one of those things that you can promise, you already had a responsibility to do anyway. It's not anything that has changed. And one other that you might put in to that list as well as to why we do not really have a contract with God is the fact that if we could ever complete it, do what God has commanded of us, then following the concept of contracts, if that's what it is, God would have an obligation to give us eternal life because we have done what he asked. And obviously, we cannot earn. As a matter of fact, from a contractual standpoint, it would be foolish for God to contract with us. If you've done any contract work or gotten involved at all with it, gotten a number of people to bid, you evaluate the bids, and part of what you're looking at is the capability of the individual or company to carry out what you're contracting for. And you throw out those who, for whatever reason, you know, past experience record of that company shows that they can't do it. They don't have the equipment. They don't have the personnel. Every indication is they're just not qualified. You don't do business with them. Or if you do contract with a firm and then they fail to live up to its terms, you terminate the contract. Under those same kind of situations, God simply wouldn't enter into a contract with us. And if he did, he'd soon terminate it because we'd do something that would be in violation of the terms of that agreement. And so it is that we're not talking about entering into a contract with God. There is indeed that area, most assuredly, just as the definition stressed, that we're primarily talking about promises. In conjunction, of course, with the commandments that God has given. And indeed, we do have as a part of that the great heir or that of the great estate that Jesus has left. And so our testator, having died, has left us a great inheritance. You and I are quite privileged. But in any event, as you think with regard to this, hopefully that you'll recognize that we need to bring ourselves within the scope, the safety of the promises that God has made. And though there's much more there, I think my time is up, and thank you very, very kindly for your attention.